listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, my name is Shane Vanderhart. Welcome back to another episode. Today we have a very special episode. Senior contributor Brian Myers is taking over. He's interviewing his cousin, Lanny Stumbo, who is a Vietnam War veteran who served with Delta Company, 5th Battalion, the 7th Cavalry, 1st Air Cavalry Division with the United States Army. Afterwards, he attended St. Paul Bible College, now Crown College, as well as Iowa State University. He retired later on from the Iowa Department of Transportation and now raises cattle on a family farm in Boone County. Lanny talks with Brian about his time in the in Vietnam from June 1969 to June 1970. So before we get to that interview, first a word from our sponsor.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Without further ado, here's Brian Myers' conversation with Lanny Stumbo.
In September of last year, PBS ran a Ken Burns-directed 10-episode series on the Vietnam War. Like many others, I watched that series with interest, and I asked my cousin Lanny Stumbo about his thoughts on the series. Lanny was a member of Delta Company, 5th Battalion, 7th Cavalry, 1st Air Cavalry Division in Vietnam from June of 1969 to June of 1970. We talked about the Ken Burns series a couple of times, and eventually I asked Lanny to sit down for an interview and share his thoughts and experiences with regard to the Vietnam War, and he was kind enough to say yes. Welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast, Lanny.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Overall, what did you think of the Ken Burns series? I know you got to watch it. Some of it you watched live, and some of it you watched on TiVo. So
I... Yeah, when I was able to record most of them, and I was really frustrated after seeing the whole thing in retrospect and understanding more of the political motivations behind the war was sort of disgusting to me as a vet who realized that at times we were used as pawns out there or to win an election, and we couldn't make decisions until after the elections and that sort of stuff. And so when you lose 150 guys that take a hill, and then as soon as you take the hill, you leave and give it back, and yeah, you gotta go win it back a second time, is pretty well frustrating to me.
So you did get all the way through the series. You got the...
I think I 90% of it.
Okay,
yeah.
And there were some things in the series that you didn't know. They were it was enlightening to you.
Yeah, right.
Not in a good way.
Yes, yeah, and more so from the political perspective of the people who were running the show, and yeah, it was sort of a disappointment in that regard. But I loved it. Watching it 50 years later, it's still good therapy for me to really realize how good life is.
Well, that was one of the things I was going to ask is when you watch something like that special, what effect does that have on you?
Well, to me, I'm not obsessed by the war, but you have to watch some of that stuff to get your mental state back to realize and bring again some of those experiences. And I don't necessarily consider them, even though they were not pleasing experiences, it still causes you to realize what a great country we live in, and so to me it's good therapy.
And one of the things that struck me, and just, you know, one of the series in particular, I remember, excuse me, one of the episodes of the series in particular, they talked about these frank discussions that were going on during the Johnson administration, in which it appeared they knew that this was not going to end well, mm-hmm. and they kept going anyway.
Right.
I mean, when you hear that stuff, that's just got to make your head spin.
Yeah, and to realize how yeah, we got to keep this going. We don't really want to, and we don't like what's going to happen here, but we got to do it because the election is a month away, and we can't do anything until after that. At the same time, people are dying over there for no real good cause.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your experience. So you're minding your own business in college, playing basketball at St. Paul Bible, which is now called Crown College, I guess.
Correct.
You get drafted.
Yeah, well, like they say when you testify in court, there's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So I went to college, and back those days, you had a four-year college deferment if you went to college. And you had to, so you were given 4 years to go to school. And but the trouble is, if you fell behind in that process, and it was going to end up taking you more than 4 years to get through, then you sort of lost your deferment and were subject to plus, they had a game called Rook, which a young 19-year-old kid that got too interested in, and I spent a whole lot more time playing Rook and basketball than I did studying. So after 2 years, I had to set out for a semester, and
Uncle Sam said, "Aha, we got you."
And it just so happened that the registrar at the college was a former bird colonel in the Army, so he didn't like little boys who weren't gonna. The moment you were dropped out of college or weren't in college, why, he sent his little note to the draft board that you're free now to list. So yeah, I got drafted because sort of my own bad decisions or laziness in my educational endeavors.
Well, back in those days, wasn't it common for those guys when they knew that they were going to get drafted to join the National Guard? Did that something that was an option for you, or did you consider it? Or
it was too late by then. By the time my second year of college was finished, I guess I could have, and I'm not sure the timing. There was such a waiting list, I think, if I recall right, to get in. I'd had to known earlier that I was going to do it. So by the time June came and my grades were, and my track for getting through in 4 years was obvious, that it was too late to get out of the guard. I'm not sure I was interested in that anyway. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Your father, he saw some pretty heavy action in World War II in the Pacific Theater. And when he knew you were going to be drafted and he knew you were going to Vietnam, did he say anything with respect to counsel for you going in, or...
Well, really, my dad didn't talk much about his experience in World War II. And so, basically, you're 18 and on your own. Basically what I think he gave me was Psalms 91, which is entitled The Soldier Psalm. And he didn't wish me well. It's not like he... I just don't remember any deep discussions about, you know, keep your head down and anything of that nature. So no, we didn't talk much about my going in. And plus, I'd been away from home for 2 years in college, so there wasn't much discussion about my going into the Army.
But he did. He really did talk to you about Psalm 91.
Right. Okay. This is called the Soldier Psalm. But he who dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. Goes on and on. So yeah, I read that probably 300 times during that year.
I bet you did.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Speaking of such things, what were your first days and weeks like when you were in country?
Yeah, I got in a unit called the 1st Air Cavalry Division, which was an air mobile division, which was basically you go from place to place in a platoon at a time, six helicopters at a time, and there were, so we also wanted to be trained to be able to repel from helicopters. So the first week or so, we had to repel from a tower and get possibly ready to have to do that from a helicopter, which we didn't ever have to do. But so
you never did end up coming out of a helicopter?
No, never had to do that. They were able to get down close enough to the ground and were able to land on the ground.
But you're over there, and obviously it's you're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah. So when we went over there, unlike what they do today, we went over there one soldier at a time. And so any given day in our company out in the field, there might be two guys going home that have been there and for their year, and there are two new guys coming out. And so the people that we were there in training with they were all split up to different battalions. So when I first got there, there wasn't anybody that went to the field, as I remember the same day that I did, to my unit in the field.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
So how long did it take you to feel, maybe comfortable is the wrong word, I'm sure, but at least you felt like you knew what you were doing.
Well, the good thing, probably a couple of weeks, you get in there, and a lot depends on your battalion and your squad leader and who's training you. The bad news is that these guys who have been over there for a while are counting every day that they check off, and it's like 3 days and a wake up, or it's 180 days and a wake up. So nobody's anxious to be the trainer of how to teach you how to walk point.
Right.
So usually what happens was the new guys got to walk point maybe sometimes sooner than they should, and their success was. The training was due to whoever your squad leader was the guy who usually came behind you and taught you, what to look for and what to see and that sort of thing. So
did you get stuck walking point right out of the gate?
Within a matter of a week or so, I think. What happens when you go out, we go out as a company, there's about 100 guys, there's three platoons, and each platoon has like three squads, and then there was a mortar platoon that walked with us that could set up and so you have about maybe sometimes 100 guys going one on a single file through the jungle. And so the rotation today, first platoon walks point, and tomorrow second, and the next day third platoon, and then within your platoon then first squad. So
yeah, it's a constant
rotation. It's not like you got to walk point every day, but it's you didn't look toward your rotation too. So maybe every 2 weeks you had to walk point, that sort of thing.
Well, don't you want somebody who knows what they're doing walking point? I mean, I know
what happens is usually when you hit contact, it's people up in front. And so a guy has 75 guys back, he doesn't care. yeah, it's not a team sport over there. It's sort of like survival. Everybody's trying to, and it's gutsy that you have. It's great if you have a guy who's a great squad leader who will. He's more important than sometimes maybe the point guy.
Okay.
Because he's able to spot stuff. Because if the front guy's new, there's very few people that want to walk point for his duration. So sometimes a guy will leave and he's a radio operator, so this guy will be the new radio operator, or he's a machine gunner because they don't walk point, or other things that might. You're always looking how to get out of walking point rather than.
No, I get it. Yeah. I get it. Typically, what kind of distance is there between men in a situation? If you're in a single column, what kind of distance is there between the point guy and the next guy?
10 or 15 feet, maybe.
Okay.
You don't want to be so close. Guy's bringing a machine gun, get both of you, but at the same time, you don't want to get the guy so spread out that he's wasted. He's up there all by himself when he runs into some contact.
Sure, sure. Okay, so you're over there. When did you have your first firefight?
Well, I don't know that when you go over there, you're not keeping a very good diary, which I wish I would have.
Understood.
Yeah. So I was within a week or 10 days, and there again, it was, you don't know who's walking point, whether it's first, second, or third platoon or whatever. So, yeah, we would maybe once a week we would run into some. What would happen is if we're in an area that they've thought there was some intelligence, that there were some people out there, you would go out, the company would go out and search that area, and if that don't work, then they'll pick you up and take you to another spot. And so that process went on. So kind of lost track of what the question was. Yeah, so that's probably not every week, but maybe. And every company is different. Some people who operate went out there and never had contact at all, and other people. And it's all a matter of when you're out there with your battalion, what happens is you go out into an area, I don't know how many miles square, but we set up a fire base, which we would have a perimeter of concertina wire and build bunkers, and then the artillery would set inside that bunker. And one of our companies, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, whatever, would guard perimeter for those artillery guys. Okay, and the headquarters had a bunker there too. So you would, and so if Delta Company was there inside that fire base protecting the artillery, then the other two companies would be out 5-8 miles away in the perimeter, just going through the jungle and looking for trouble. And so
so is that what you found yourself doing a lot, is just wandering through the jungle looking to make contact?
Oh, yeah, that stuff. That's all we did.
So you're just going out there trying to find the enemy.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes they have intelligence, and, you know, this is 50 years ago, so headquarters would determine where we go. And so we would go out, and they would go one direction, we'd go the direction, and the third company would be in there as a guarding. And then we would take turns. And so we might exchange, our company would go out, and Alpha Company would come and do the perimeter guard for the artillery, and our company would go out into another area and hunt for a week looking for Charlie.
Well, when you found him, I mean, were there times when you were just overwhelmed by the numbers?
No, not the way sort of we, because the way we're strung out, whenever you have a contact, if you can back off, it's not like sometimes we're taking a hill, all right, and they're dug in and we think they're entrenched in bunker complexes, and other times we just happen to find a trail and walk down a trail and we encounter the enemy. And usually what happens is that first squad is the one that hits contact. And if you do it by accident and somebody might get hurt, then your first reaction is to drag that guy back and get him back and go back. So you go back and join the line, which is never broken, but depending on what happens, whether you're stuck or pinned down, or whether you have somebody wounded and it has to be taken back so we can medevac him out. So we didn't have great numbers of, at least in our experience, of just all out battles against
superior numbers
or anything. Okay. But other companies did, and so that's there's a hill they were talking about in this series that the general said we have to take for whatever reason, and so they kept pushing, and we lost 152 guys in one day or in that battle taking that hill, and then they turned around and walked away.
Yeah.
And then they later, I was just reading in one of my magazine's books that was written, and we went back not too far later and lost 70 guys taking it the second time. And that's the frustrating part of what you get into over there.
But was that something that you guys, I mean, you recognized what was going on at that time?
I had no idea that happened.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I had no idea what happened to almost anybody except in our own battalion.
Okay. And nothing like that happened in your battalion that just seemed pointless or senseless and really bothered you at the time?
Not at the time, no.
Okay.
Toward the end of my tour, Bravo Company, in fact, is when we went into Cambodia. We'll talk about that later. We can talk about it.
Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the challenges that the climate and the topography were for you guys. I mean, you've got jungle, you've got highlands, you've got swamp, you've got all kinds of things going on.
Yeah.
So well, talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, they have monsoon rains for 6 months, and they have hot weather for 6 months. So for 6 months, you go to beds soaking wet overnight, and you sleep wet, what happens is we live out there. We have a poncho, which we turn into a covering over your body while you're sleeping. We have an air mattress we blow up and sleep on. And So as we encamp at night, we would form a circle, this 100 guys, and try to close it up by the time you get a circle, and then you put a trip flare wire out around the perimeter. And so then you take your poncho and tie the knot off on the top and take four corners and tie it to four branches and sneak under it and blow your air mattress up, and that's what you
there's your bivouac.
Right. And so then we dig a foxhole and we take turns pulling guard overnight, and we hope nobody shows up. And
but sometimes they do.
Yeah, we were pretty fortunate that that didn't happen to us very often. Killed a couple bears that came in one night and tripped the and what happens is it's dark, you don't have lights, you don't use a cigarette light or nothing, so
but that flare goes off
and inside that those trip wires we have claymore mines set up to explode. And so when you're back 40-50 feet, however long your claymore you are from your claymore, the trip flare goes off and you blow them all anyway, you don't know what's out there. And
yeah,
couple times there were people, and you know, once it was a bear. And, we didn't get hit too bad at night. But what was worse was the fire bases, because they're a sitting target. You know, they've been there. Helicopters come in and out of there all the time, and so you're a sitting duck. And so we're more exposed when we go into the fire base or pulling guard for the artillery people.
You were more likely to get attacked there than you were in the other scenario.
It kind of depends upon where you're at, but our experience was they were more vulnerable than we were out there in the jungle. Because sometimes if there wasn't anybody there, if your intelligence was bad and we were out there wandering around and there was nobody there to find, then they didn't catch you at night. So.
And of course, you felt really bad if you didn't run into Charlie, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, anyway, and so the rain is a pain in the behind, and mosquitoes are just something like you've never seen before. And, you know, they have mosquito repellent, but that getting it regularly is good luck. So you go to bed soaking wet every night in the middle, and it pours and rains at night, and you got to keep guard. And so in the middle of the night, you're dried off finally. And so then you got to either stay up all night and pull guard, or you take the radio to your next buddy in the hooch and wake him up, and he pulls guard for the next.
And you talked about being in the jungle, you know, and your line is going through this sort of impenetrable mess, and you're hacking away with a machete to make your way through it. You mentioned that to me the other day, and I thought to myself, yeah, that's you're being real stealthy there.
Is there something wrong with this picture when you have a, you know, machine, M16 has a little handle on it.
Yeah, yeah.
That you have a machete in left hand and your right hand and a gun in your left hand, and you're literally chopping your way through one man at a time. It's so thick, goes through this hole. And somehow you think that they don't know you're coming.
Yeah.
I mean, you're whacking away. Yeah. So it wasn't always that way. But there were times when, and then you got a pack on your back. It's not that you got to get through to. So you have a little hole there. And you wonder why you walk up onto somebody and he's right there in your face. And it's like, and it doesn't happen often, but, you know, it's pretty vulnerable, that point, man. And,
Yeah,
so he finds somebody, and you got a machete in your hand, and you're not ready to shoot. So
the point guy is vulnerable in the best of circumstances, and obviously that's not the best of circumstances.
Right. Yeah. It's bad enough if you have a gun and you're just looking, but when you have to be whacking your way, and that doesn't happen all the time, but there were times when it was just ridiculous.
You mentioned you were in firefights maybe once a week. The first time you're in one, I mean, are you just kind of in shock, or does your training kick in and you know?
No, you just freeze and sometimes it's more vulnerable, at least for us, when the point people, the squad, were up in front. Because when you're back, I don't know how far you get strung out, maybe a quarter mile, when you have 100 guys that way, You can't help them. You don't know where to go. And if it's a contact with several people, you can be, depending on how do you catch up and form a wall when you can't see where you're going and you don't know where the other guy is. They're all hunched down. And there was more than one time that I'm sure we shot one of our own people because of bad communication and trying to get up there to help. And so part of the time, if the third squad platoon was in fire, in contact, we were just sitting back there doing nothing, waiting, because we couldn't help. And we didn't have a plan to get up there and to somehow help. And like I say, the first reaction is sometimes when we would make contact and somebody was wounded, we just pull back, and then we'd come in there with an airstrike, and then we would try it. So not like we were intentionally looking for a firefight. And the exception was when we're taking a hill and stuff and we think we want to try a different procedure.
So because of the conditions there, friendly fire was a big problem?
Not a big one, but it had them a couple times.
Okay.
Because sometimes when we stop for a break for a while, they might send out a squad to go out and just do a little recon about what we're getting ahead of time. And it's coming back in to your own. I mean, we can't see nothing. You hear noise out there. Some crazies just start shooting. And you don't have, if you don't come back in exactly the same place you went out, you might be coming in on a different part of this perimeter. And they, you don't have that much visibility.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very tricky sometimes.
But they were sending small groups out. How big's a squad?
Maybe seven guys.
Okay, and they're sending seven guys out just to check and see if Charlie's close to the perimeter.
Right, so that we don't start and set up camp here real close to something that's, a bunker complex or something. So
okay, all right. What other challenges did you face there as far as logistical, strategic? Logistical, you already mentioned you had trouble getting supply for mosquito dope.
Well, yeah. I mean, we get food and water every 3 days, basically. And sometimes they have, clothes was another thing we had. You get clean clothes, be lucky to get it, and they just throw out. It's not like they give you your size. They might bring out a pair of 48-inch waist. So you basically wore the things wore clothes until they fell off, kind of. Not quite that bad, but.
Well, speaking of which, how about boots? Because I would imagine you guys went through boots pretty quick.
Actually, not that bad.
Really?
Yeah. Well, no.
What's the chuckle for?
Well, you'd be lucky to get a new pair of boots.
Okay.
I know. You never take your shoes off at night once in a while, but most of the time you wear them and you go to bed with your feet wet and you've got jungle rot and mosquitoes. And they also had these pinch bugs and when you went to set your hooch up at night, you had to spray and clear off these hooch bugs because they would poke holes in your air mattress.
Really?
Yeah, and they bite a hole in it. So now you're sleeping on the
bad boys.
Now you're sleeping on the ground instead of, and they could bite you too. They weren't that bad, but getting a new air mattress out there was like trying to pull teeth too. Uh-huh. So we were, food and water. And we weren't really ever shorted on that. But when you're talking about a clean pair of socks, you don't carry any extra clothes with you. You know, all you have is on your back is water and food and machine gun ammo and stuff. And so
now, stupid question, but you never had any trouble getting ordnance though, correct?
No, we didn't,
okay.
I can't speak
right.
for everybody.
Well, speaking of those kinds of things, did you personally experience the problems that some of the guys did with the M16 jamming?
No, we didn't. And I don't know, in our platoon, I don't remember hearing about, because you can clean it. When we stopped, and every time we get resupplied for food every 3 days, we can clean it and we can keep it pretty dry.
I suppose it's possible they had made some improvements to the M16 by 1969. I'm not real sure about that, but I know at least at one time it was a huge problem, and it was a big controversy back here in the States.
Yeah.
Because there were stories about guys They'd find a guy dead in his foxhole. He's got his gun and his cleaning kit there.
Oh, really?
He jammed in, you know, his gun had jammed in a firefight. And so, yeah, okay. You never experienced that.
No.
You mentioned earlier you were part of the invasion of Cambodia in the spring of 1970. Tell us about that.
Yeah, like I say, the minute you go to Vietnam, you don't know if you're coming home, but you start your calendar, and everybody knows how many days you've been there and how many days you got left.
Right.
Why don't we talk about Halong Bay? Every day is Halong Bay. Well, I got 180 days in a wake up. So you always took it from the how many days do I have left? And my problem was I'd been in there for a year, and I got 45 days left, and we said, oh, hey, we're going to invade Cambodia. I said, oh, wonderful.
I can't wait.
Yeah. I mean, here I've sweat this thing out and counted my calendar for 320-some days, and now all of a sudden we're going to invade. And, you know, you never know what's over there, but you know that's where we don't go. And that's where they go frequently and without...
And you guys knew that that's where a lot of the supplies were coming.
Yeah.
You guys
yeah, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was over there in Laos or whatever they call it, and Cambodia up and down that thing all the time. And they had vehicles to carry stuff. But most of the stuff inside, we never found any vehicles or anything inside Vietnam that were could be in different parts of the country. They snuck in somewhere. But everything we had, they had to carry in on their backs. And
Yeah. I've seen pictures of the VC bringing all kinds of stuff on a bicycle, some critter or something.
And that was the frustrating part of the logistic. We had such great firepower, and we were playing down to their level. That's the bad part, you know. So we were walking through. They know how to live in the jungle. They've done it all their life, and they're good at camouflage and not making trails and all that sort of stuff. We're out there trying to play their
game.
Yeah, and it just that was not the way to fight that war, unfortunately.
So, you found out you were going to Cambodia. Was that? I mean, like, did they tell you like a day before you went, or did you know a little in advance? Or
I think we had a week or so notice. I don't recall exactly, but we weren't too excited about it.
Did you know at the time how controversial that was back home, or how controversial it would be back home?
No. The only thing, I think the government controlled the radio stations, and we had the Stars and Stripes Forever or whatever was the magazine they sent out to us, and that was the only news we really knew, other than people, letters from home and people that come in and out from our company all the time.
Yeah, because you got new guys rotating in pretty frequently.
Yeah, because Kent State happened in that, I think, May of 70, we heard about that, but, we're pretty well in the dark.
Okay.
I mean.
Yeah, it really, really, there was a lot of, as you know, there was an awful lot of controversy prior to that. But the invasion into Cambodia just really ratcheted up the controversy and the protests and all the rest of it. And then Kent State happened. And, you know, I was fairly young at the time. But, you know, when this stuff was going on, you're kind of thinking, what's going on here? I mean, it was a pretty scary time domestically,
right,
you know, because of what was going on over there. How did you personally feel about the mission in Vietnam while you were there? Or did you think about those kinds of things?
Well, having been in college for 2 years before I went, you sort of just assume that we're going there to stop communism from coming and taking over South Vietnam. So it's an honorable thing to do, so we're doing it. And so that was about the extent. We wasn't too informed politically, because I had my own life at college. I didn't get too involved in politics.
We had Rook to play and basketball to play.
Yeah, they set your priorities.
Well, so, and I think I touched on this earlier, but while you're there, you're still thinking you've got a good cause. You're still thinking that the mission is a good one. Even at times when you're looking around saying, the way we're doing this isn't a good idea. Yeah. But the mission is good. And was that common in your unit? I mean, did everybody kind of feel that way?
When you talk about common in our unit, I only know about 7 guys. That's my squad, and a little bit in the other squads, because you don't have a whole lot of time to talk. You whisper all the time while you're there, because morning, day, and night, other than when, and I'd say we didn't talk, but it's not like you sit around in the jungle and talk about things.
But you didn't really have a lot of exposure to the rest of the guys in the platoon. It was mainly the squad?
Our squad, yes, because 1st and 2nd platoon, they were always elsewhere in the jungle. You never had any gathering times. You might be talking to a guy when you change guard at the bunker or at your foxhole at night. And the days that we had got resupplied, there was a lot, we had people watching on the perimeter, and so there was a lot more relaxed. You could write a letter, try to get it off, and we'd talk to one another. But you never sat around in groups of two or three.
And you were a squad leader, correct?
At the end. When I first got there, I wasn't.
Right. Mm-hmm. But so 10 months in?
No, about 4 months in.
Well, that's not towards the end, Lanny.
Well, yeah.
So you got a promotion fairly quick.
Yes. Yeah, I got promoted within 30 days the first time. I went over there as a PFC, and then I got promoted to corporal and then to sergeant and took over a squad.
So tell me why that happened to Lanny Stumbo.
That's good. No. I'm really glad I grew up on the farm. I was an outdoorsman. I was a hunter. The M16, the gun was not a foreign object to me that I had to learn. You're over there. You might as well make the best of what you got. And so there were some people who are there for a whole variety of reasons, and they had never shot a gun in their lifetime and that sort of stuff. And so, it just fit me better than for somebody else. I could have taken a radio job, but it didn't. And I think I was trying to do the best I could. And I suppose you don't put in for it. You're told you're going to be one. You know? So he had to make their choice. And I was one of them that were asked to do it, told to do it.
And so you got pretty tight then with the guys in your squad.
Yeah.
And that ratchets it up even more because you're their leader.
Yeah, right. And so that means that when he would walk point, I'm right behind him. So because I have the radio access to the radio, behind me is my radio guy. Is when you're a squad leader, you have a radio because you're one walking point. You have to be telling what's up here. So that last 6 months, probably I was a squad leader.
Did you lose some guys in your squad?
One guy. A couple guys over the year. And then when I left, a couple weeks after I left, my replacement went, and 3 or 4 squad leaders were all killed by our own artillery.
Ugh.
So, yeah. What happens is when you are out there in the jungle and you're looking, and now these people, the fire bases, are artillery rounds, 155s or whatever, 105s, whatever. And so they're meant to be there to where if you get in a firefight, then they can be shooting artillery around you and then bring that in on top of your enemy to help you in those situations. Problem being is you're all dealing with coordinates there's a radio operator in there that is, say, they send out a test round that explodes up in the air and you know where that is, and you say, all right, my enemy is 100 yards left and 100 yards north or whatever. So they adjust that from that one that explodes up in the air.
But if you make a mistake...
And if they make a mistake 4 or 5 miles away, 10 miles, I don't know how far they shoot, sometimes it falls short. And that's what happened after I left. The guy that replaced me was... It hit, inside the perimeter, and my replacement was killed, and a couple of Scholastic kids, too.
Kids you knew?
I knew the squad leader, my replacement. I didn't know all the names of the guys that were the other kids. But knowing the way this whole thing rotates, you know, had I been there a couple weeks later, I wouldn't be here. But, so anyway.
So, when the invasion of Cambodia took place, did things go well there? Or when you got over there, was it just chaos and pandemonium? Or what was that like?
No, they went pretty well. I shouldn't say that. toward the end, Bravo Company really got into... when you get in places over there, you're heading into finding headquarters where they bring all their supplies and they station them over there. This war had been going on for 10, how many years, I don't know. So when you find something pretty big. And so Bravo Company found there was a hill and had a big bunker complex on it. And so it was well guarded and well fortified. Fortunately for my squad, my platoon, it happened to be Bravo Company out there trying to take that hill, and instead of
Delta.
So they lost about 10 guys trying to take that hill, and when they took it, they had so much ammunition and grenades and rockets underground out there, it took Bravo Company a week to haul that stuff out of there.
Wow.
I mean, it was, thousands and thousands of rounds and mortars and guns. And so everybody in the whole battalion, which was about 500 people, got to take home a rifle souvenir. That's how many stuff. And there were pistols in there and sniper rifles.
You name it.
Yeah. So, it was tough going for that company, but we didn't. But we were we were on the fire base that got overran. 2 weeks before I went home, so we got hit pretty good on a fire base in Cambodia there before we left. So that was pretty hairy. So,
but that you must have somehow or other run them out.
Yeah, well, when you have all those cannons or those, what happens when you have concertina wire around a perimeter? And they start, they shoot, we had a couple of 8-inch guns, and think about our 8-inch artillery gun, and a shell filled with nails and screws and stuff.
Canister,
they just shoot them online right out there into the tree line. And so what had happened is they shot so many rounds out of there that the concertina wire protecting the compound was pretty well shattered. But also the tree line was pretty well mutilated, and... luckily, they didn't. they didn't get in. They might have got something through the wire, but my squad had to be the wonderful job the next day of going out and recon in the area, and so by that time they had left. But there were some casualties there, and one of the interesting things that we found a racket made with rockets setting on it that was already set up, ready to blow into our compound there. And we took one POW, and another guy was, Viet Cong was killed by one of the guys as we were taking, going due to the recon. But one of the dead soldiers I found had both of his legs were blown off, and he had two tourniquets on each knee, on each leg, and he was the one carrying the starter, the crank that would blow off all the rockets. And luckily, he was killed before he got to the rockets that were setting up.
Wow.
Going down there. So that would have done the job on us inside the compound.
Well, so was that was that fire base in Cambodia? Was that the worst experience you had over there?
Yeah, that was the worst one we had, trying to be overrun.
And you're 2 weeks from going home.
Yeah, a couple. I don't know exactly the dates because, you know, we don't keep track of that stuff. But it was, yeah. And we went in there in May, and I came home in June. So somewhere, I'm not sure exactly when that fire base was hit.
But. Well, which raises a point. I was going to ask, so you get to the last day. And are you still in Cambodia at that point?
Yes, I think, yeah, I did, because what happens is, you know, when you're one night and wake up, so you get out every 3 days when you get your, if we were in a fire base, I would have went out of the fire base, and I can't remember where this was at or where we went back out, and when we resupplied, I went in on the helicopter, and from there they shuffled me back toward the States.
And you have a feeling of relief and euphoria?
Not yet. Yeah, because of rockets and mortars, you get back to, actually, we got back to the rear, and then they send you by helicopter to Benoit, where the Air Force base is. And it wasn't until you see that bird on the, I got a picture somewhere of my freedom bird, we call him.
And that, the one's going to take you
home.
The
one's going to take me home. Yeah. Yeah, there you're in the air base, and you look out there, and you see that 747 or 37 or whatever it is. We don't care what it is.
And that's when you start to feel okay.
Maybe. It isn't until you got to be off the ground. You can shoot them out of the... Yeah, you got to get off the ground and get 10 miles outside of the... Yeah, so it was when you're in the sky, 5 minutes after you... then you feel like, wow, maybe I'll make it home.
Do you have any recollection of troubles reacclimating yourself to civilian life when you got back home?
Only I think I was a little bit, I remember my wife and I, or my girlfriend and I, who can be my wife later, we were out, her dad was building a cab or a house out in the timber area outside of Omaha, and we were out there looking at the progress of the home, and somebody was squirrel hunting or something and shot a gun, and I sort of hit the deck when a shot went off. But after we got home, you know, I didn't really have any shell-shocked reactions or PTSD stuff.
Okay.
Except if you don't really deal with it. I remember when my cousin and I from Minnesota, he is also a Vietnam vet, and I recall that when we went into Kuwait, well, I don't know, how many years later is that? 10 or 20?
Yeah, that would have been early 1991, maybe.
20 years later. I remember the night on television, watching the television coverage that... and so I was mortified of that, because you wonder if... Because everybody knew tomorrow we were going to invade Kuwait, it was sort of like reliving that tomorrow we're going into Cambodia scenario. And so I stayed up all night listening to that coverage. And for whatever reason, I just wept. And I embarrassingly so, I had to teach Sunday school the next day. And I went to Sunday school. I remember teaching and sort of lost it in Sunday school class with my high school kids. I don't know why. But that being said, sometimes with that, as I talked to my cousin much later, we had talked about that same event. And he said it happened to him too. And he said he just broke down. And he said he had tried to call me that night, just to see how you're doing. And it was just strange how that was really the only time that I really felt having to deal with the thing that maybe let out all that, some of that emotion. And that's the thing.
Two decades later.
It was, yeah. Yeah. It's weird. But and so now I'm able, I mean, it's never... messes up my mind, but if you watch a movie like Platoon or something, and I think it's good because it still reminds me of the experience and how I benefited personally from that ordeal.
So when you get home, you're saying you're not really having any struggles per se, but obviously, you know, from the spring of 1970 on, it was obvious and plain that the people of the United States had had enough of this war.
Yeah.
And that we were going to be eventually getting out. And how did you feel about that? And like, did you see some of the footage of the exodus from Vietnam in the spring of 1975? And did that just kind of make you crazy? Or?
Well, yeah, you realize, number one, I didn't like the way we fought the war. After Kuwait, that shows you how if you're going to fight a war, like Rush Limbaugh says, wars are to kill people and break things.
Yeah.
And when we went into Kuwait, it lasted 100 hours, so killed hundreds and hundreds of people, and we didn't lose one soldier. And that was that's the way you're supposed to win a war, as much as you hate fighting wars. And so we went out there, and we wasted lives, and we went out there with machetes, and we should never have fought that style of war. And between that and the way that we realized that we were sort of manipulated by the government, we made it very frustrating, but I did not, it was good for me personally to go through that experience.
And the fact that maybe politically speaking, it was a horrendous mistake, that hasn't had a profound negative effect on you. You got past that.
Yeah. Right. I think I was just able to move on and not have to,
because there's apparently a lot of guys that just really, really never were able to get over that.
Right. And everybody's experience is different, and I think there was people that had a lot worse experience than I, as far as being around their friends and casualties and stuff. And my mind was probably in the middle of the extremes. You know, there are people who slept in beds all for a whole year, and my journey wasn't quite that bad, and having to take that hill, Bravo Company did that instead of Delta Company, and so just maybe the good Lord is watching over me.
Well, speaking of such things, what role did your faith play while you were there? You mentioned earlier that you had memorized that psalm and had repeated it multiple times.
Yeah, I read it multiple times. I've tried to memorize it. But anyway, I had a very strong faith going in, and I knew that there were people, hundreds of people praying for me at home, and so I had great spiritual support, and I was confident of my eternal destiny, so I wasn't worried necessarily if I was going to die. That being the case, when you don't know if you're going to die today or not, why, you're always pretty well prayed up. And you haven't had any encounters with people that you said, I wish I hadn't said that, and that sort of stuff, because you just, this is your life, and you got nowhere to go. And so you're sort of always at peace with God. At least I was. There's some people who have, when they talk about there are no atheists in foxholes, there's always people that were more afraid of the next life or the uncertainty of the next life than I was. And so I was comfortable in my faith, and it was a good experience in that regard.
Did you have anybody else in the squad during that period of time that was also a believer that you had any fellowship with? Or
No, not really, no. We had a couple conversations about, you know, there were some of those people that said, if I've got to get me out of this, I'm
going to turn my life around. I'm really just gonna get out of Vietnam.
I'm really going to change. Yeah.
But you, so in terms of spiritual fellowship, there really wasn't a lot. You were kind of on your own, and the Lord.
And there's really no time for that anyway.
Yeah.
You know, we don't.
You're too busy trying to stay alive.
Well, yeah, and you walk all day, and you sleep all night, and other than Pulgard, and other than those 3 days of, or when we, there were two more times at top when we were in our rotation of guarding the fire base. It was a lot more loose there, and we had more conversations and stuff that, I don't recall any real deep spiritual fellowship with another brother over there.
Okay. You've mentioned a couple of times that this experience was good for you. What impact did it have on your faith that carries on to this day?
Well, there was a time when I was, on my 22nd birthday, I was sitting in a foxhole, and I just got a Dear John letter from my girlfriend that said she didn't think. So I got dumped on, and there were times when you were frustrated with where you're at, and you didn't know if you're going home, and you always got to evaluate, you know, why am I here, and what, and so... In every man's life, they have to, in lady's life, they have to determine whether I'm going to follow my parents' faith or I'm going to have my own. And so this was, allowed me a good time to evaluate that. And every time I might have been thinking about dumping the whole thing, why then, you know, you've seen your parents' faith and the faith of others who have remain strong, and so it just for me it just allowed me to say, well, let's keep giving it a try, and then it becomes my faith and my journey, and so yeah, so that part it was good for me. So and you realize that we have a blessed country here, and we have so much to be thankful for. Those people have nothing, and they're still, some are happy. And for the few times that we did see people, friendlies and kids, we have a few times that we were, they had nothing to live on. And we went out, one of the times that I was out in the jungle, we came across this thing that looked like a big cardboard box with a big hunk of plastic over it. And I happened to be walking pointer or squatted or whatever, anyway. I opened it up, and there's this old lady in there with had leprosy, and so she had leprosy. So her family had put her out there and stuck her out there like a dog in a doghouse in a big cardboard box and covered it, and that's where she was going to live until she died because she had leprosy.
That was her home.
That was her home, and so that and other experiences. You see people live in poverty, and we realize that we just have a great country here, and so that reinforced. Yeah, and so I think I've learned to be able to live with a lot less than I really would I need to, and between that and my walk with God, it was sort of the worst time of my life and the best time of my life.
So. Did you have situations? I mean, it's at least in the movies they make it sound pretty common.
Good guy always wins, don't they?
Well, no. Interestingly enough, not when we're talking about movies with respect to Vietnam. Yeah. Good guys don't always win.
Right.
But it seems to be pretty commonly understood in books and movies that it was extremely difficult to know who you were fighting against.
Yeah.
You'd have a village full of people and you have absolutely no idea, you know, if they're a friend or a foe. And that's got to especially be difficult for a Christian to go into a situation like that where, you know, he, on the one hand, he knows he's got to find the enemy and kill him. Mm-hmm. On the other, there may be a bunch of innocent people here that he has a Christian obligation to, you know, to keep from harming.
Mm-hmm.
So those have to be difficult situations for you as a Christian when you're over there.
Yeah, and part of the problem is you run into the whole May Lai massacre that happened during there, William Kelly, and you know if you haven't been in conflict, it's hard to realize how anybody would ever do anything like that. But if you see your best friend get shot up walk into a booby trap and his legs are blown off and all that sort of stuff. So it's hard to judge them.
Too harshly?
Too harshly as they would from 15,000 miles away or whatever. You can't, and then what they did was sort of wrong. But there were times when intelligence would say, there are no friendlies in the area. You know, this intelligence says, and so whoever's there, you shoot them. And one experience that our company did get involved in that, and we opened up on some people that I didn't think were armed, and we did, one older gentleman was killed, and the rest of them, I don't know, we were pretty bad shots for as many bullets as we shot in their direction, and only one person was killed, unless there were some wounded. But that was the whole pathetic part. It's one thing to shoot a guy that's got a gun and coming after you, and it's another one. Luckily, I wasn't on that side of the perimeter when they were going after it, but... So we didn't, there was one incident where that happened, and I thought it was sort of sad to be involved in that.
But it sounds like there's like you said here a few moments ago, this was a profoundly positive experience for you in some respects.
Yeah, right. I think it just molded me into, to who I am, whatever that is. This is what you get. So I think I'm pretty comfortable living in a pretty simple accommodations, even though, and satisfied with, making a living, and don't have any great plans to become wealthy and all that sort of stuff. Of course, my age is nobody's making any more.
That ship has sailed.
Nobody's making very many plans anymore.
As we wrap up here, Lanny, any final thoughts on either Vietnam, your experience there, the political mistakes we made, all of the above?
Well, I maybe act like I'm. Was really down on the Army. I was only down on the Army because of the way, and at the time, you're involved in it, you just got to live through it. But, you know, when you look back at the military, historically, you know, in the Civil War, we stand in line 50 yards away and shoot at each other, and not wide open spaces. And even and in Vietnam, we go through jungles and, with a gun in one hand and a machete in the other, and in the middle, and now we walk down in Kuwait or wherever, and you walk down the street and wonder which car's going to blow your legs off. There's got to be a different way we can fight that war, and that's why I was sort of insinuating that Kuwait's a way to find a war. As much as you hate that way, we fought it, we beat it with our best weapons, and it was over quickly. And we, in that case, I don't think we lost anybody in that encounter. Well, it lasted 100 hours, from what I remember. So, between that, so I am a very strong pro-military guy, and I'm proud of to have served there. And so, I just have a little tweaks about the way they sometimes fight their battles.
Well, Lanny, thanks an awful lot for coming on Caffeinated Thoughts podcast today. I know some of this stuff was probably difficult for you to talk about, but we really appreciate you coming on board. Thank you very much.
You betcha.
And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. Again, that's caffeinatedthoughts.com, CAFFEINATED, caffeinated thoughts, or just Google caffeinated thoughts, and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our emails. That way you don't miss a single update. Also, you can find this podcast on Podbean, on Stitcher, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, who am I missing, Spotify, I think that's it, so there might be one or two others, I can't remember off the top of my head, but, you know, there's several ways you could subscribe to this podcast. If you happen to listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star rating, we'd appreciate it, but that way, if you subscribe, you don't miss a single episode, and you can listen using your favorite podcast app. So until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Thank you so much for listening. Take care.